Hello and welcome to the BICOM podcast. I'm Richard Pater, the director of BICOM, and today is the 11th of April. My guest today is Professor Rosa Friedman, who is the chair of Law, Conflict and Global Development at the University of Reading. She's also a leading expert in international human law and how it relates to international relations. She serves as an advisor to UN committees and to the British government. And she's also a research fellow at the London Centre for Study of Contemporary Antisemitism, and also the editor of their book series. So I'll say in the start, if any of you of our listeners are budding authors and want to contribute to writing on antisemitism, then Professor Friedman is your point of contact. Professor, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So we'd like to talk about, obviously, kind of the pressing issue about aid relating to the Gaza Strip. And obviously, that's an issue which is kind of occupying the attention of a lot of the international media. And before I get into it, I'd like to just frame it that we want to discuss both some of kind of the legalistic aspect and some of the factual aspect of exactly what is under there. There are different versions of events of what's happening in Gaza at the moment. According to the Israeli narrative, there has never been a shortage, and there are plenty of they say they're flooding the Gaza Strip with aid, and there is enough for everyone. However, the other bodies within the international community have a very different version of events. So we're looking forward to getting into all of that. But perhaps we can start with your expertise on the legal issue, and in international law terms, perhaps you can lay out the responsibilities that Israel has in the Gaza Strip.
In order to understand what's going on the ground, we have to understand that even during times of war, there is an international law, international legal system, shared values that are common to all nations that govern certain aspects of war. And this really goes back to the beginning of international law, which started by looking at things like shipping and things like warfare, things that are affect different countries at different times, but affect all countries in terms of these values common to all nation states. Even within times of war, there are certain rules that are followed by all but the most pariah of states. And when we're thinking pariah states, we're thinking countries like North Korea or Iran. That might be to do with the types of military weapons that are being used. There's been a long-standing campaign to ban landmines and cluster munitions because of their disproportionate effect on civilians during the war and afterwards. But it will also be to do with international humanitarian law. And that really focuses on how civilians are treated during warfare, as well as how prisoners of wars are treated by warring parties. And at the core of international humanitarian law is about the protection of civilians. Now, we know that during times of war, civilians die. Sometimes this is referred to in what sounds like a callous way of collateral damage. Collateral damage might be about buildings or about civilian deaths. And we heard a lot at the beginning of the war, conversations about proportionality, because while we accept that civilians die, it must be proportionate to the aims of the war itself. But also, it's not only about civilian deaths, it's about humanitarian aid and access being allowed into those civilians during the most difficult of times. That at its core, those are the things that are needed for people to live, like food, water, shelter, and healthcare services. So the basic law around this focuses on the warring parties and particularly on occupying powers. Now, we can have lots of discussions about whether or not Israel occupies the West Bank and whether or not Israel occupied Gaza prior to 7th of October. I have my own view informed by law, but people can argue it both ways under international law. Certainly, though, since Israel's ground incursions into Gaza following the atrocities on 7th of October, Israel has been an occupying power in Gaza. And there are additional responsibilities and duties on occupying powers during times of war and after the war ends.
So that's the kind of the legal framework for this. How do you see Israel as meeting these obligations in practice?
Since very early on in the war, We heard different statements from different parts of the government. I'm not talking about the extreme right wing Ben-Gvirs or Smotriches, but even the Israel Defense Minister quite early on talked about not allowing fuel into Gaza, not allowing food into Gaza until the hostages were released. Some of those statements have been taken completely out of context, and others of them have been taken within the context they were made. But just to be very clear, those statements from particular politicians did not actually inform the military practice or the government policies on the ground. Food and fuel have been going into Gaza since the beginning of the war. The big question is whether it's been sufficient amounts of food and fuel and access to humanitarian organizations to deliver services on the ground. It's very clear that different crossings have been opened at different times to allow these trucks to go in. And there have been big discussions about who should go in to the trucks themselves to see what is being taken across the borders, because we know over many years that aid delivery trucks have often taken over weapons or people that Israel doesn't want to be going into the hands of Hamas. We won't know fully until the end of the war and until investigations have been conducted, which cannot be done during wartime, even with the best of intentions, the extent to which Israel has ensured that aid could reach people on the ground. We need to be very clear about one point, though, which is it is not Israel's responsibility, once the aid goes into Gaza, to ensure that it's distributed to civilians rather than being taken by the terrorists on the ground. That is the responsibility of the humanitarian organizations operating on the ground. And there is very little that can be done by Israel, or by its military to ensure that food and water and healthcare that is delivered gets to the people who need it. Now, during times of war, in all conflicts and crises, the people who most need the aid are the least likely to get the aid. And that includes children, the elderly, people with disabilities, and very often women and girls in many societies. And again, that's not on the responsibility of the occupying power to ensure that those people receive the aid. That is where the humanitarian organizations that you've heard of, whether it's the International Red Cross, UNICEF, whether it's UNRWA itself within Gaza. So that responsibility is on them. Now, we have to be very realistic about this. If we think about the war in Syria and the war against ISIS, in order to deliver humanitarian aid on the ground, there had to be what we call good corruption, sometimes bribing of militias, sometimes paying them money, sometimes giving them aid in order to get trucks through. We're seeing that currently in Afghanistan. We're seeing that currently in terms of the gang violence in Haiti. I'm just naming a few other conflicts so that we can understand how this operates on the ground and how this plays out in reality. But there is a very big difference between bribing militias with money or with food and allowing aid trucks to take weapons directly to those militias to use as part of their warfare. And this is really the sticking point around delivery of humanitarian aid in Gaza, is the extent to which not so much the aid is going into the hands of the terrorists, but the extent to which parts of that aid could be used as part of Hamas's war against Israel.
And just as a, I suppose, as a side note, what's the obligation of third parties, in this instance, kind of Egypt having also kind of the only other country with a border with the Gaza Strip?
Okay, so we've heard a lot about Egypt and the crossing in Rafah and whether or not that crossing should be opened. The crossing goes into Egypt itself, but the crossing is run by Egypt with the support of Israel. Israel enforces what aid goes through and doesn't go through, partly, around this conversation of aid trucks being used to deliver rockets or fuel to be used for rockets to be fired into southern Israel. But also Israel helps to control that border because of the people smugglers in Egypt. We're hearing widespread reports that people smugglers in Egypt are benefiting greatly financially from the war by smuggling out those who have money through the tunnels. And we know that those tunnels have been used for many years for the black market, as well as for Hamas's own end. So we have to understand that not Egypt doesn't control that border on its own, firstly. But secondly, Egypt's not an occupying power. If we talk about Israel's role ever since the withdrawal from Gush Katif, it has still continued to blockade land, sea, and ports of Gaza. on three sides, other than the Egyptian side, which does, in many interpretations of international law, make it an occupying power of this self-governing but non-autonomous region. That's a very legal jargon to say Gaza is an area that governs over itself, but is not its own state and doesn't control. Part of statehood is controlling your seas, controlling your airspace, which Israel has taken control of time and again since 2006. So the obligations on Egypt may be humanitarian obligations, just like there are obligations on countries where, on Chad, where Darfuri refugees are fleeing from the Janjaweed in Sudan, who are slaughtering the black Africans as yet another arm of Iran and another arm of radical Islamicism spreading across the region. So there may be humanitarian obligations, but they're certainly not the types of obligations that Israel is under as an occupying power.
And now, I mean, if we can, I wonder if you could just lay out kind of the map for us, kind of the various, you mentioned kind of the role of the international organizations. If you can just map out for us the current state of play of who is operating there, and maybe give your assessment about their efficiency and their role.
The United Nations was created in 1945 to really prevent another world war, but also recognizing the conditions of what causes world wars or international armed conflicts, largely relating to human rights and to development. Lesser developed countries and societies are often far more politically unstable and fragile. With greater amounts of inequalities and divisions within those countries and between those countries. Part of the United Nations role, as well as being a place for all states to meet to undertake diplomacy around how to prevent international armed conflict, as well as all other areas of diplomacy. But the other part of the UN's role was actually to go out into countries to help with, first of all, the decolonization processes, whereby, we now have 193 UN members. When it started, there were only 50 or so because most countries were under colonial rule. But part of that decolonization process was also development, building roads and schools and hospitals and infrastructure, supporting states' capabilities to run and govern themselves, supporting technology in the modern era, and so on. What that means is that there's a huge humanitarian system within the UN that's aimed at times of peace as well as times of war, and that is aimed at things like girls' education programs in many countries, water and sanitation for the billion people who live without access to safe and clean drinking water or to toilets. And that's also aimed at all the other aspects of development that we can think of. That humanitarian system is in place in countries, but also is quickly and easily movable around the world. And during times of conflict or famine or natural disasters, those organizations are already either on the ground within a country or in neighboring countries and can swiftly move in to deliver humanitarian assistance and services. So that UN system includes lots of organizations that we'll have heard of and that many people donate to, UNICEF being a very prominent one. You also have a system of affiliated organizations, international, non-governmental organizations. Who also come in and help deliver relief on the ground during times of grave hardship and crises. It would be impossible to name them all, but many of your listeners will have heard of ones that are very formal and well structured, but also ones that are less formal, like Care for Calais, which sprang up in recent years to help with the refugee crises in Calais of migrants trying to cross the sea into the UK. At each layer of the organizations operating on the ground in Gaza, you have to think, how do the individuals get into the country? Now, some are given visas by Israel to travel in across Israel to deliver humanitarian aid and relief. Some will have had the same from Egypt and will have had to cross the border with both Egypt and Israel's consent, remembering that both countries can control that border together. Others may already have been there on the ground. Often within Gaza, the people delivering the relief are Palestinians themselves. They might be dual nationals, and we hear a lot about dual nationals who go to work in hospitals in Gaza for a few months per year. We also have the same with organizations like Partners in Health in Haiti, where you have Haitian dual nationals who use their annual leave to go to Haiti to deliver free and safe medical services on the ground. Many of the international staff for these organizations aren't actually in Gaza themselves. Many of them are based in Jordan, some in Lebanon and Syria, but many in Jordan, because that is the country where they have the easiest access to go across Israel to meet with staff from Gaza that are allowed to come in, or even to go into Gaza where they absolutely have to. But most of the people providing humanitarian assistance in these big organizations on the ground in Gaza will themselves be Palestinians, or, as I say, will have had to have visas from Israel.
And what can you tell us about, I mean, one of the smaller organizations that has come to the fore recently is the World Central Kitchen. Obviously, there was the tragedy just last week of seven of their workers that were killed by misidentification in Israeli strike. I suppose beyond the tragedy, there is also a bitter irony that, from my understanding, this was one of the organizations that Israel had placed the greatest amount of trust in. Just for our listeners, what can you tell us a little bit about the background of this organization? And although they've now declared that they've frozen their operations in Gaza, what are the prospects for them to return one day?
So this organization was actually set up by a very famous chef who has a deep commitment to providing food, not only in conflict zones, but also in, as I was saying, lesser developed countries, and in empowering local people in those countries to cook clean and healthy food. In that way that, you know, we talk about give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day, teach him how to fish and he'll eat for a lifetime. That's sort of the premise behind much of the work that this organization does around the world. What it also does is goes into conflict or crisis zones to deliver meals on the ground. And one of the bitterest ironies of this all is that in the days following 7th of October, this organization provided 2 million meals to displaced Israelis. And one of the reasons that Israel and other countries trust it so much is it is politically neutral. And what we know is that many of the people who go into the conflict or crisis zones are themselves experienced former military personnel, and that they are there in that same way with political neutrality that UN peacekeepers and other peacekeepers are expected to have, simply to deliver humanitarian assistance and protection on the ground. So that's a sort of background to the organization. And one of the reasons why it's so well trusted is this political neutrality, which is often deeply lacking in organizations that operate in Gaza and that operate in the West Bank, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan in relation to Palestinian refugees.
Well, that takes me on to the kind of the, if you were talking about the organizations that are non-political, what can you tell us about the politicization of those that do operate there as well?
Over recent weeks and months, the conversation has very much turned to what to do about UNRWA, the UN agency that operates on the ground in Gaza, West Bank, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, specifically focused on what is termed the Palestine refugees. Now, UNRWA was created in the aftermath of the creation of the State of Israel, the attacks by neighboring Arab countries, and what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the flight of many, but not all Palestinians from their homes or from their lands into neighboring countries or regions. UNRWA was set up as a way of providing relief and works, it's a UN relief and works agency, to those people on the ground in the immediate aftermath of that war. Now, remember, this was a time when there were still displaced persons all around Europe, right? Not only the victims of Nazi Germany, not only Jews and Roma, gay people, communists, but also people who had fled their homes during fighting, or soldiers who were simply trying to return back to their countries having fought in this awful war. There were displaced persons camps set up all around Europe, and there was no specific agency tasked with dealing with them from the United Nations. UNRWA, therefore, became the first kind of refugee agency of the UN, but it has a very specific mandate of only dealing with the Palestine refugee. Within a couple of years, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, was created to deal with refugees all around the world, and it's specifically starting with Europe and this large number of displaced persons. The UN Refugee Agency was specifically tasked with not dealing with refugees from Palestine. It was specifically told you have this global reach except for the Palestinians. And there was a very specific reason why. The Arab countries didn't want Palestinian refugees to be treated like all other refugees, to be resettled into new countries if they couldn't return to their own countries, and to be assimilated within new societies. Now, not all refugees are able to seek asylum in the countries that they live in. For example, the Rohingya, who are a Muslim minority in Burma, or what we now call Myanmar, have been, many of them have been living on the borders with Bangladesh since the early 1990s. Bangladesh is not a signatory, it's not a party to the UN Refugee Treaty, so it doesn't have to provide asylum to those refugees. And so many of those refugees have had children and then grandchildren who themselves remain refugees. They can't go back to Myanmar where they'll be slaughtered, and they can't claim asylum in Bangladesh. Many of the Palestinian refugees who ended up in Syria and Lebanon and Jordan were in a similar position. Those countries are also not party to the Refugee Convention, and therefore they don't have to give asylum, they don't have to give citizenship to those Palestinian refugees. Many other Palestinians or their descendants who fled have ended up in America, in the UK, in Greece and Canada, where they have acquired citizenship and are no longer considered Palestinian refugees for the purposes of UNRWA. UNRWA is focused only on the five regions that I mentioned, Gaza, West Bank, and those three neighboring countries. UNRWA provides services to all of those individuals, school services, hospital services, but crucially also jobs. Unlike all other UN agencies, UNRWA is almost exclusively staffed by the people that they're supposed to serve, by Palestinians. They have become a sort of state in waiting. So UNRWA has teachers, as we would expect, and it has doctors, as we would expect, but it also has bin men and people to sweep the streets. It's become a civil administration, which then allows Hamas in Gaza, or Fatah, or the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, to be political governments without actually providing all the services that we expect from our governments, like people who are sweeping the streets or changing the bulbs in lampposts. And so UNRWA has gone from being an agency tasked with delivering relief and works, right? So literally providing shelter, providing schools for children, and helping people to get jobs and assimilate and resettle into the countries that they're in. It's moved from that to become a Palestinian state waiting, a state administration waiting for a state to be created around it. It is a symbol of the Palestinian national cause. It has become its own brand, which is more trusted by Palestinians than their own political factions. And for many Palestinians, they are more scared of UNRWA being disbanded than they are of changing governments in Gaza or the West Bank. And this is according to UNRWA's own surveys. UNRWA has become about the only stable force in the lives of many Palestinians who are living in these five regions. At various times, changes have been proposed to UNRWA, to its funding model, or to its operations on the ground. And there's been huge resistance from the Arab countries who don't want to have to provide those services, let alone citizenship, to the Palestinians. Now, there are people who will claim that the Arab countries don't want to do that because they don't ever want peace with Israel. I'm not here to discuss the kind of political motivations, but certainly in terms of the operations on the ground, assimilating millions of refugees into already poor countries is much more difficult than asking for UNRWA to continue to provide all the services that are needed for those individuals. The problem with UNRWA, and there are many problems, but the biggest problem with UNRWA is this lack of neutrality, right? We expect the UN agencies that come in and deliver aid on the ground not to be part of the political conversations that are going on to do with, you know, wars or conflicts or land or statehood. And UNRWA time and again, because partly because it's so heavily staffed by Palestinians, but partly because even the internationals working there recognize that they are a symbol of Palestinian nationalness. They cannot be neutral where it comes to conversations about one state or two state solutions. All of the other criticisms around UNRWA all come back to this lack of neutrality point. Now, there have been attempts even during this war to bypass UNRWA. We saw the donors, many large donors, stopped funding UNRWA when evidence was produced that some UNRWA staff had been involved in the 7th of October atrocities. The UN Secretary General came out very strongly and said, no other agency operating on the ground is allowed to accept money that should be going to UNRWA, which sounds ridiculous. If the aim is to get food and water and shelter and healthcare to civilians on the ground, it really shouldn't matter to the UN Secretary General which organization is delivering that, so long as the help is provided. But the reason goes back to this point, that the UN is now invested in UNRWA continuing. And if other organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières or UNICEF are able to deliver that, those services and that aid on the ground, it would go to show that UNRWA is not needed in the way, you know, it's not the be all and end all of service provision in Gaza. And so the UN Secretary General was very clear that none of these agencies that were operating under the UN umbrella were to take that money. There are conversations going on about what to do with UNRWA the day after the war ends. There are proposals, some of which are extremely viable, even if the UN doesn't want to accept them, that either UNRWA can be disbanded and other aid agencies take over, or that UNRWA could be turned into a regional hub for all refugees in the area, right? The Yazidis, Syrians, Kurds that are fleeing, whomever they might be, rather than only focusing on the Palestine refugee. And then there are all sorts of proposals between those two on the spectrum. What is clear is that the day after the war ends, UNRWA won't be allowed to continue in the way that it has been operating, particularly around terrorists or terrorist sympathizers that are given jobs and are within their midst and are abusing their power to bring in weapons and other things through UNRWA aid trucks and elsewhere that are used to commit atrocities against Israeli citizens.
Wow, thank you. And this spawned a whole range of questions, but I just wanted to come back to something I mentioned at the beginning and just get your assessment, this divergent version of events between the Israeli claims and some of these bodies. And you've made the case about some of them being neutral, some of them having a political agenda. But where do you stand in your overall assessment of kind of the scope of the need and the aid that is already going in?
Let's be clear that what's happening in Gaza is a humanitarian catastrophe, and it's unfolding in front of our eyes. And I don't believe in comparing catastrophes with catastrophes. I don't believe that you can talk about proportions of civilian populations or how people are dying or how much food they have. This is a humanitarian catastrophe. And it's a catastrophe on lots of levels. The first level is simply around food. Yes, statistics show that there are more food aid trucks going into Gaza now than there were before 7th of October. Let's remember how fertile the soil is in Gaza, that many Israelis who have had strawberries from Gaza say they're the best strawberries they've ever eaten. Gaza was growing its own food. Maybe it wasn't enough food to feed its population, but it didn't need more food aid trucks going in while it was growing its own food. Much of that land and many of those people are now unable to grow that food. People are starving in Gaza. There's the people who are starving, as I said earlier, are the vulnerable minorities, children, the elderly, people with disabilities, people who are the least likely to be able to access aid. And we know that food and aid generally is being stolen by the terrorists. But there is a humanitarian catastrophe around food. There's also a humanitarian catastrophe around safe drinking water. Access to safe drinking water is an absolutely vital part of being able to live and live a healthful life. Diseases like cholera become endemic where there is no safe drinking water or access to sanitation, literally to toilets. And then raw fecal matter flows and people get sick with cholera, and where there are no functioning hospitals or few functioning health services, people die from a very easily treated disease. Then there is the midterm humanitarian catastrophe, which is currently many people are living in tents or they're living in overcrowded housing or they're living in schools. The day after the war ends, people will need to move out of those schools because children need to be in schools so that parents can go out and find work and start to rebuild their lives. Once everyone moves out of the schools, we're going to see tent cities for years. And the reason I say years is that many of the buildings will need to be pulled down and rebuilt because they are hazardous, because there are electric cables running around, because they may have their foundations may have been broken. But to rebuild Gaza, donors will need to give money and building materials to Gaza. And donors will not do that until they are sure that the war is over, that Hamas will not restart the war by firing rockets, and that Israel will not go back into Gaza. And that may take many years to come. So the humanitarian catastrophe will also be people living in tent cities and yet another generation growing up, not in the towns and cities that they had in Gaza previously, with the jobs and the schools and the swimming pools and the everything that, that people need to live normal and healthy and productive lives. But people will be growing up, children once again, in tent cities. And so that is the second part of the humanitarian catastrophe, which no amount of aid going in now will be able to prevent or remedy. The only thing that will remedy that will be a ceasefire and negotiations that lead to lasting peace that will then allow Gaza to be rebuilt. How that happens, I'm afraid, is beyond my expertise, but it won't happen while there is still a war between Hamas and Israel.
And just at your thoughts on another international organization that has got mixed views here, the role of the Red Cross. We've seen the Israeli appealing kind of that they haven't even visited the hostages at all, whilst we had this quite unexpected intervention by the foreign secretary David Cameron asking for the Red Cross to have access to the Nukba terrorists in Israeli prisoners. What did you make of that claim, and more broadly about the role that the Red Cross can and should be playing?
The Red Cross has one fundamental purpose, and that's to visit prisoners of war, hostages, kidnapped during times of conflict and crisis, to be a neutral body that is trusted by all, to visit, to assess medical needs, to make sure that there is contact with families and so on. It has absolutely failed in terms of the hostages. Time and again, it's failed, and it has not explained why it has failed. But I think it's fairly clear from the outside to understand that it's failed because it has to work with Hamas in order to operate on the ground. All organizations have to work with Hamas to operate on the ground. If they were to criticize Hamas openly, they would be signing their own death sentences as individuals, and the organizations would not be allowed to continue their work. And part of the Red Cross's work on the ground will also be looking after wounded and injured and sick civilians. So they have clearly made some form of cost-benefit risk assessment analysis and decided it's better to remain active in Gaza and to absolutely fail in their duties, their foundational duty towards the hostages and hostages' families. There is no debate about that failure. It just simply is a failure. That doesn't mean that they don't still have a mandate to visit prisoners. Whether those prisoners are terrorists or whether they're civilians is irrelevant. The fundamentals of international human rights law is that every human being holds human rights by virtue of being born human, irrespective of their race or their age or their sexual orientation, and irrespective of whether they are a terrorist or not. I often, when I do school assemblies for small children, tell them about the idea of human rights is that if you've got 100 children on a bus and a terrorist who set a bomb, and the only person that knows the combination for that bomb is the terrorist, human rights say you cannot torture the terrorist to get the combination for the bomb. It's a fundamental to human rights, and it can't be deviated from. And that is why the Red Cross want to go and visit the prisoners. I don't see the two as being dependent on one another. They have failed on the hostages, but that does not mean that they ought to fail on the prisoners as well. I was interested, though, that the Red Cross once visited a Nazi concentration camp and wrote a very famous letter about the conditions being absolutely fine. I think that where an organization has utterly failed a minority in the past, that there would be an expectation that if they were failing that minority again, that they would come out and explain why. I think that, to me, is deeply problematic, that they have been silent over their failures on the hostages. I don't think that this means that we cannot trust the Red Cross generally. I just think it means that in this situation, Israel and the hostages' families and anyone who cares about the hostages being released and about their well-being cannot rely on the Red Cross for this situation.
Thank you. One last question, Jen, just pick up something that you said a little bit earlier about kind of the in the scenario where the fighting has ended, and obviously there's going to be an enormous amount of building materials that come that need to be brought into Gaza to help with the reconstruction. One of Israel's long-term issues has been the issue of dual use, usage, and clearly we now know in hindsight that it's been manipulated, that a lot of the buildings for infrastructure projects went to help contributed to the labyrinth of the tunnel network. What sort of mechanism, having learned the lesson, can be put into place that Israel can work together with the international community to help that rehabilitation?
I think the question is an important one, but the angle is the wrong one. Until there is no longer a terrorist organization controlling this region, then anything brought into Gaza will first and foremost go through that terrorist organization, and they will decide whether or not they want to steal it or use it for nefarious purposes. Now, I don't believe that this war needs to continue as it is in order to root out that terrorist organization. America fought against Al-Qaeda for years without waging war, an ongoing war on a specific region. There's been the rooting out of ISIS started with destruction of Raqqa and other cities, but the ongoing fight against ISIS hasn't been an ongoing fight, a war within a region. I think this war started under Israel's right to defend herself in international law. But the fight against Hamas will be able to continue without an ongoing war in Gaza, right? It's time for the next set phase of these operations against Hamas. But until Hamas is rooted out, then any building materials or any other things that are brought into Gaza will still be under their control. That is the nature of terrorism and of terrorist governments. So I think the bigger question, the more important question is how can this war against Hamas continue while stopping the war in Gaza. But I think that that midterm humanitarian catastrophe will last until Hamas is rooted out, because I don't believe that there is a foolproof way of bringing reconstruction materials into Gaza that won't then be used by Hamas to increase its hostilities and military actions against and terrorism against Israel. And I don't think the donor countries will be willing to rebuild Gaza while Hamas still has those capabilities, because if Hamas commits even a tenth of the atrocities again that they did on 7th of October, Israel will exercise its right to defend herself and go back into Gaza and destroy any new buildings that have been made. So I think the most important question is how do we make the day after come quicker? I.e., how do we get rid of Hamas as a terrorist organization?
And I'm sorry, I know I said that was the last one, but if you indulge me, just one last question, because I think just trying to piece together what you've given a fascinating presentation is just I'm still struck with the concern that I think a lot of Israelis have as well over the dire humanitarian situation and the suffering of the non-combatants. Given what you've told us about the infrastructure and the lie of the land, what are some of the immediate steps that the Israeli government could recommend, or the international community could be doing to alleviate that suffering?
The most immediate one is negotiations of a ceasefire, which can only come about with the release of hostages, hostages' bodies, and those hostages that are still alive. That ceasefire cannot come with the strings attached that Hamas have asked for, which is includes Israel providing military vehicles to Hamas for Hamas to use against Israel. But yeah, the most important one is a negotiated ceasefire, which again there are talks going on once again between Egypt and Qatar and America. And I think that something that many people don't realize is that three ceasefire negotiations have failed because Hamas have turned down the agreement, not Israel. The thing that Israel can do, the Israeli government can be doing right now, is just keep opening more border crossings, keep allowing the Jordanians to bring in more aid, to keep opening the ports, which they are doing. You know, every couple of weeks we hear about a new port or a new crossing being opened and flooding those crossings and ports with humanitarian aid. Ultimately, there is little that can be done to provide clean access to clean and safe water, other than literally bringing water into Gaza currently, because so much of the infrastructure has been destroyed, and so much of the water infrastructure has become polluted through this war. But the only two things that can make any difference right now in the here and now on the ground are a ceasefire and just opening more aid delivery routes.
Thank you so much for your insights today. Let's hope collectively that we reach that ceasefire and that we can talk in the future on happier occasions. But thanks so much.
Thanks, Richard.